You're listening to WWBC, Cocoa, Merritt Island, Melbourne, Titusville, and the Beaches, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI, Cocoa, Vieira, 94.7 FM, and W264AS, Melbourne, and Palm Bay, 100.7 FM.
Hello, Space and Treasure Coast. This is Sita Biggie on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, FM 99.9, and FM 100.7. We are also heard live on the web at WWBC. There's an app somehow. You should just go and download
it. On demand.
I have done it as well. It's on demand. We're going to have a fantastic show today talking about real bread and butter issues. Mm-hmm. We always say don't compromise on education and healthcare. And boy, we're going to talk a lot today about healthcare. And we're going to talk a lot today about what people are doing right here in the United States to foster children. So Matt Price is here. Welcome.
Hey, thank you.
So nice to have him in the studio. Because we talked on the phone so much. And when I finally, we've met before, I meet everybody.
Yeah.
And then I forget.
Speaking of healthcare. The Brevard Democrats.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. It's something about with the Brevard Democrats, of course, or maybe other things that we're all involved, like-minded groups, of course. And Ellen Little is here. So, Ellen, welcome.
Nice.
Yeah. Welcome back.
You. Welcome, June.
I should say welcome back because you weren't here last week.
I know.
Yeah.
Had a holiday. It's a holiday.
So we have an action-packed show, but I didn't think I was going to mention the shooting in Virginia Beach, but it has been weighing heavily on my mind. So, you know, I'm not one to say thoughts and prayers anymore. I just can't do it anymore. I have to say we need to speak with our legislators all over the country and ask them to please put themselves in the shoes of the family members and the victims' family members as well who are suffering today because of gun violence in our country. And then Ellen said there was one here in Merritt Island.
Yes, in Walmart.
It's almost like, why has it become so normalized to hear shooting and then turn the other way?
Right.
I saw in Chicago they had over 10 people this weekend that were killed as well due to gun violence. Mm. So, I mean, are we really addressing the right things? Mental health?
Right.
You know, I mean, sometimes I feel as though we're missing the mark. And mental health is a big thing. And also the safety. If you have a gun, make sure it's locked up. Make sure you're securing your family members and the public. No one wants to take away anybody's Second Amendment rights, but my God, we have to be careful.
Yes.
You know, because now they're saying that the guy had threatened people before.
Right.
So what is that old saying we always talk about? If you see something, say something.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Don't
and
wait.
And he had just quit his job, I believe. There was a whole lot of elements that went to it.
Right. And we get all upset when there's a shooting and then it fizzles out. It just fizzles out, and then we go about our everyday business until something happens again. And then we see the usual breaking news.
Right.
And, you know, that's it. Then people just, you know, so for me, it's like, I just don't know what to say anymore.
And, you know, it certainly is a tough debate, but there are some things that we can do. I know that there are things that we're doing. We're all really smart people. We got to start figuring this out. I have my own ideas about it. Of course, I've told you before. I don't know if I've said it on air or not, but that... You know, one of the things, since we're talking about healthcare today, is I think for gun violence, you have to release all your HIPAA. You know, if you decide that you want to get a gun, I want to know if you've been on any psychotropic drugs in your life. You know, so you kind of lose
always,
your...
I've always said, all. You know, one of we have to do a lot of assessments as nurses, right? Assessments if somebody's going to fall, assessment if they're smoke, if they smoke, if they're risk to flee, whatever it is. So why not have an assessment when you go to buy a gun from your family members?
Yeah.
Family members will be very honest and say whether their sister, brother, ex-husband, neighbor should have a gun. Who knows people better than the people in their lives? Like, I know a few people that I think should not have a gun.
Right.
And we have to, I mean, we give...
Right, when their behavior changes, you can see it.
That's right. So why not just add that on and say, well, if you'd like to have a gun, that's fine. That's your right. But here's a questionnaire for your eldest brother or sister to fill out. Right. Or maybe a surviving relative who's very close to you that knows you extremely well.
That's right.
And fill that question. Now, that doesn't mean they won't get a gun from somewhere else. But at least that's a proactive step, don't
right.
you think?
And yeah. I think there's lots of proactive steps like that yeah. that we just
common
haven't
sense.
Taken yet. Yeah,
you
exactly.
know, my mother used common to say common exactly sense was made before book sense. And that's one of the things I live my life by is that, yes, you have to have common sense.
Yes.
Right? So talking
just
about
not so common anymore.
You don't think so?
It's just
like,
not so
like I was talking to a friend of mine, and I said that we're going to have a woman named Lori Ross calling in from Foster Adopt today. And
she's on the line.
And we were talking about children and the responsibility of children. And my friend said, you know, I'm so tired of women always getting the brunt of the blame for pregnancy. What happened to the men that impregnate these women?
Right.
How come we don't hold the men responsible? Where are the men? And I said, that's a good question, but the thing is, it has to start from young, where we do encourage comprehensive sex education at appropriate ages, as well as a job, vocational, college, whatever it is.
Right.
Because oftentimes you hear the woman gets the blame. It's the burden of proof is on the woman for 9 months, right? Mm-hmm. And then the men, where are they? We got to find them. No, not
no
you,
offense.
Matt.
Yeah.
Because Matt already said that he's not involved in that right now. So anyway, so we found this wonderful group on Facebook called Foster Adopt. And I've been connecting with Foster Adopt Connect with a lovely lady named Sarah Jeffries, who I have to say is was very kind, very accommodating, and very knowledgeable about foster parenting. And so we chatted for a little bit, and she told me that Lori would be calling in. Lori Ross, who is the founder and CEO and president of Foster Adopt Connect. And I think she's on the phone. For my listeners who are tuning in to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends today, Lori and her husband, Randy, have foster or adopted since 1985. And together they have cared for over 400 foster children. And they have adopted 23, ranging from the age of 5 to 34. These are some wonderful people. We need more people like Lori and her husband, not just in the United States, but around the world, to give children love and compassion and take care of them. So, Lori, I understand you're on the phone?
I am.
Thank you so much for taking the time to call in on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. We really, really appreciate it. We need more people like you and your awesome husband.
Oh, thank you so much. We appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
Yes, and I've been reading on your website about your mission and how you guys got started, and I can't believe such a small group grew so much. So tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and Foster Connect, Foster Adopt Connect.
So my personal story is that my husband and I started fostering in 1985 and started with one little six-year-old girl who was, you know, angelic looking and actually not quite as angelic on the other end because she had suffered a whole lot of trauma prior to coming to us. We ended up adopting her when she was 10, and we just continued to foster over the years and ended up with 23 children that we've adopted from the foster care system since that time, and we did foster over 400. I really lost count after 400 all the kids that we've had over the years were, you know, you pretty much can imagine that if you have 400 kids, you've probably had kids of almost every racial background, almost every religious background, with a wide variety of different kinds of reasons for having come into care, and the challenges that come with some of those reasons kids come into care, their experiences of trauma or developmental issues or physical health care issues, those kinds of things. And after we'd been fostering for a while, we got connected with a group of folks who were operating a small support group and started participating in the support group. And we were the most experienced folks at the support group meeting. At that time, we'd been fostering about 14 years. And the group decided that we wanted to collectively do something to make the work of fostering children who've suffered abuse and neglect easier for families like ours. So people who become foster parents are just normal, everyday people, and they don't come endowed with any special magical parenting skills or some knowledge base that makes them perfectly prepared to foster other people's children who've suffered abuse and neglect. Instead, they're just normal people, and they need a whole lot of supports as they delve into doing this as a family mission in order to be able to be successful in meeting kids' needs. They have a lot to learn. They have a lot of systems to interact with, and they really need people that they can talk to and count on and rely on, as well as, you know, connections to all kinds of resources that assist them in that journey.
And Lori, to just to ask really quick, because I know I'm listening to you and I'm thinking this lady probably needed a lot of emotional support. Where did you and your husband get emotional support to foster all these children?
You know, you get some of that from the existing group of people that support you in your life, your parents and your siblings and your friends. And sometimes those folks are very supportive of this decision that a family makes, and sometimes they really struggle with it because it isn't easy all the time. And so people who love you might be tempted to say, well, this is really hard on your family. Why are you doing that? When what you really need them to say is, hey, we're here to help you if you need help. So we ended up getting, surrounding ourselves with a group of friends who were also foster and adoptive parents. And in that way, we were able to be retained as foster parents, and that is one of the key challenges of the foster care system, is being able to retain foster parents long enough that they not only, you know, can make a real difference for kids, but also develop the skills that are necessary to help kids who have increasing levels of need. And so our key supports were obviously the normal folks and then a group of foster parents who became our closest friends.
And what are some of the decisions that people have to make before they decide to foster a child? What are some of the crucial things that someone should know if they're thinking, well, gee, I think I would like to foster a child?
Well, you know, foster parents usually come to this either because they feel a genuine desire to make a difference for kids who are suffering, or because they have some connectedness to a child who, for whatever reason, has to come into foster care. So it may be that they're a relative or a teacher or a coach or a friend or a neighbor, and they suddenly find that someone they actually know and care about is coming into foster care. And that group of people, the ones that are already have some connection to the child, those folks typically come into it at the last moment in the heat of a crisis and when someone they care about is on the line. And for those folks, there's nothing really that prepares you for that, but they do walk in the door with an already established connection to that child or their family, which is very beneficial to them. So they get wrapped around with the same kinds of supports that foster parents who are strangers need. They need training and they need resources and they need, core supports from friends and folks who are going to support them as they do the work.
I know, we were just talking prior to the show. I was talking to a friend about the movie that we all saw, Instant Family. And we all learned so much about fostering children, becoming a parent, communication, making sure you have your issues worked out before you foster a child. I think we need more movies like that and more people to talk about fostering children and parenting. And I think Matt, our guest who is in studio today, he's a nurse like myself, and I know he wants to jump into the conversation because we want to know about healthcare for the children. So Matt's going to ask you a question.
Yeah, I was just wondering, how do you all provide for the medical needs for over 400 children? That seems like a lot.
Well,
a lot of prayer.
Fortunately, actually, I don't know how anyone would do that. Obviously, our healthcare system in the United States is not ideal, and no one independently, other than maybe, billionaires, has the capacity to take on another person's physical and mental health needs with no support. But fortunately, we do have a publicly funded Medicaid system, which provides for the cost of health care and mental health care for children in the foster care system nationally. So for us, the reason we've been able to do what we've done is because our kids were able to have their pediatric visits, their specialty appointments, and their mental health treatment through Medicaid.
Thank God for Medicaid, right? Yeah. I mean, we're trying to have that expanded in the state of Florida as well. So, Lori, tell me, so how do you approach fostering children if you already have children of your own and you want to bring children into the home?
Yeah, that's a big decision point. You have to really give that some thought, because it actually is a family mission. Your children really need to be on board with the plan of bringing other children into the family, you got to have some really frank and honest conversations. Now, for my husband and I, we started fostering when our first birth child was a baby. So our children, and we ended up having four more birth children along the process of fostering. So our children never knew our family in any other way. We always had foster children in our home. That was just part of how their family was. They never knew it any different. But when I interact with people who started fostering later, after their children were older, it's been really important for those kids to have some buy-in to the idea of fostering. And then a whole lot of conversation around how to create safety and make sure that your birth children don't feel displaced, because foster children need a lot of attention and time and energy. And also to make sure that the age order is something that you've given a lot of thought to, that you're paying attention to what's going to work well for your particular kid and your particular family. But the really great thing about fostering children is that you have to go through a really pretty intensive preparatory process, where you're not only going to classes and learning about it, but also doing a really intensive home study. And in that process, it challenges you as a couple, as a family, to really think about what it is that you are able to do within your home. Social workers do end up talking to the birth children in your family and finding out how they feel and talking about how your family is going to be able to adjust.
Yeah, because I would think that you could have a lot of resentment at times in a family if it wasn't approached properly before you bring somebody into the home.
Yes, absolutely.
Because that happens in normal families. You have resentment and sibling rivalry within families that there are no adoption or no adoptive children that are brought in.
Right. So I always tell people it isn't that you let your kids make the decision for you, but you really need to have the kids be part of the conversation. Because for me, it was always important that my birth children never feel insecure, that they always know that they were staying forever, even if other children came and went, that they always knew that we loved them. And when we were raising their siblings, who some of whom had really significant behavioral issues, that they felt like their needs were also being met, that it wasn't just that all of our time and attention was going to that child who had the more significant issues.
So we should take a break here, Ellen, and we should tell our listeners who we're talking to Lori Ross, mm-hmm. and Lori's calling in from Adopt Foster Connect in Missouri.
Missouri.
I don't know why I was thinking of Kathy Bates in that movie, and I just can't say Missouri.
Missouri.
We say Missouri in Missouri, too.
So, Lori, one of the things I was thinking about when I thought about having you call in, I was thinking about how about respite care for, I was thinking 400 children. How did you and your husband, did you have people that came in and say, listen, we're going to give you a little break? Because I would think you would need some sort of a break for yourself, because caregivers, whether it's nursing in the nursing profession or whether it's a hospice patient or whatever it is, you do need to take care of yourselves as well. So how did you find that balance, that healthy balance to take a break?
So yes, absolutely. You do need help, and you need it in just the day-to-day aspects of living so that you can give that individualized attention to your partner and also to children as they need that. So that could look like maybe an after-school helper that we hire from, the high school, the local high school, or it could be a neighbor or a friend or a formal respite provider who we set up a relationship with. Early on for us, my mom was very helpful, and she would do, we tried to, my husband and I, to take a trip by ourselves once a year. So when my mom was younger, she was our respite care provider when we would do that. And now we have grown children, and they're happy to pay off debt by doing respite care for us.
Nice.
You know, there's never an end to when mom and dad are the bank account. So fortunately, they owe us enough. They'll be doing that for a while.
So I was reading online, and I read where your group began to expand from 8 families through word of mouth. What other means did you all use to spread the good things that you're doing with Adopt Foster Connect? Yeah, word of mouth, you have your website. So you'll have to give us your website as well. And tell us where you got your referrals from and stuff like that.
So Foster Adopt website is, Foster Adopt Connect website is just fosteradopt.org. Perfectly simple.
Yes.
And we did start very small. And actually what we found as we got started and began offering some basic services like training, and we were giving things away that would benefit families, was that people were desperately wanting to connect with other people doing this work. Foster parents who are out in the community are oftentimes isolated, feel like they can't go out in public. You know, when they have a child who has some serious behavioral issues, they may feel like they're stuck at home. So one of the nicest things was that as we started the group and people started to come to it and try it out, they were able to finally feel normalized. They were able to look around and see, oh, this is an experience that everyone who does this has. And, oh, look, that child over there is having the same kind of fit my child has when I say no.
So like shared experiences you had.
Totally.
And I love where you all set up your one-stop shop where people came together. And tell our listeners on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends how you all came together and set up. I could just see it in front of me, like I was visualizing it. I'm like, wow, this is like Christmas every day with this one-stop shop.
Right. And honestly, that was exactly it. We realized that people needed support in a whole wide variety of different domains. So they might need food, or they might need clothes, or they might need furniture, or they might need books on parenting, or they might need training, or they might need individual support as they were trying to navigate getting a problem solved for a child in their home. And all of those things were just part of our one-stop shop vision. If you're a foster parent out there and you're struggling, we want you to know all you have to do is find us, and then we'll help you find whatever else you need.
Right. And so that, yeah, I see that. And, you know, I was thinking as I was reading, you guys are able to employ so many social workers and professionals to help the children. What do you do when you come across children who have a lot of mental issues? Because I would think a lot of these kids that you get, that you all foster, they probably have parents, or maybe they don't have parents, and a lot of them, their parents showed no responsibility for these children. How do you cope with so many children that have mental issues?
Well, there's a lot of supports and services to try to work with families when they're parenting kids who have significant mental health issues. There's always counseling therapy. There are a variety of different kinds of therapeutic programs or groups kids can be involved in. The one thing that we created as a response to the needs that families had to be able to safely maintain kids with really serious needs in their homes was a program called the Behavioral Interventionist Program. And that provides a one-on-one, highly trained interventionist who goes into the family home to work directly with that child on helping them to maintain their regulation, emotional regulation, helping them to achieve their activities of daily living without having a breakdown every 5 minutes, and doing a whole lot of activities with them that help encourage the parts of the brain which are impacted by trauma to begin to heal. Neural developmental activities, which are really basic things that typical developing children experience. And kids who have trauma oftentimes have interruptions in that. So you'll see, scientifically, neural pathways that have been wired to trauma responses instead of appropriate responses. And there's a whole lot of science behind it. But basically, we try to create a situation where any family can maintain a child no matter what their level of need is within their home, so they can continue to provide the love and nurture by having an extra pair of arms, an extra pair of legs right there to help intervene with that child so that the family can continue to go on with the day and the child can still get the individual attention they need to be able to de-escalate from whatever has gotten them escalated.
Well, Lori, you know, I feel like we could speak to you forever, because the subject that you speak of and caring for the most vulnerable in our society is one that so many of us are interested in. But I just want to ask you a question. You know, we live in a time now when there's so much hate and division, and people are not very careful with the words they use. We often find even politicians and business owners and people in our community are so reactive instead of proactive. And you see things from all angles when you see these children, these lovely children that need help and that you guys have fostered over 400. What can you say to people listening on our program today with the remaining minute? How can we help prevent issues such as having all these children that are born to people who are just so irresponsible? I mean, we're grateful that you all are there. But what can we do to help humanity, to help the United States, so that we can protect these innocent children?
Well, I would say one of the things you mentioned earlier, the expansion of Medicaid allows for a lot more mental health treatment and substance abuse treatment for parents. What we have found over the years is that the parents of the children who come to our home largely are people who should have been in foster care themselves as children. They've had traumatic childhoods themselves, and they bring the damage from those early life experiences into their role as parents and are unable to pull it off because of that. It isn't typically someone who is wanting to be irresponsible, but more a person who is, a traumatized former child who has never been able to be shown the example or to be given the support to do well. So any programs which lift up people in poverty, any programs which encourage adequate health care and mental health care, any programs which provide early childhood assistance, child care, early childhood education, any programs that exist out there that really are reaching out to those who we as a society would say, you know, the most struggling, most vulnerable members of our community, are going to make a difference in terms of reducing the population of children in foster care.
Right.
I've never met a birth parent whose child was in foster care who didn't absolutely love their child. These are not people who don't love their children, but they're people who are not able to parent because of the things that they missed out on when they were children.
Right, so we have to become a kinder, more gentler world and not be so judgmental, and do extend our hand to those who need it amongst us. And I love that, what you say. I know my producer is signaling to us that we have maybe 15 seconds left. I just want to thank you for calling in, and Ellen has a few closing words.
Yeah, and I've posted the website on our Facebook page so everybody can go check that out and find out more about you. And, of course, we will be listening to our sponsors real quick, and then we'll be right back with Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
Portions of Viewpoint with Sita and Friends is sponsored by the friends and family of Sita Begee, author of 18 Brothers and Sisters, and founder of Simply Sita Skincare, and these great sponsors. Portions of Sita and Friends is brought to you by Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture Store inside the Merritt Square Mall at the Sears Wing. Save big on furniture working with a flexible family-owned store with all the brands you love, from Ashley, Serta, Coaster, Enso, and more. Brand new, warranties as well, and delivery and haul away available at a fraction of the cost of most stores, and delivered in 7 to 10 days. Free, no credit checking and financing, and free interior design. The owner, Scott Palmer, has been in the mattress and furniture business for over 30 years, and Cloud 9 has been serving Central Florida for 7 years now. Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture Store, available at 321-459-2473. Again, call them 321-459-2473 or visit them on the web at cloud9furniture.com. When you need medical care and need it fast, MedFast Urgent Care is faster and less expensive than emergency rooms. MedFast is open 7 days a week, now with 8 locations serving Brevard County. So if you have an emergency, need a physical, or when your doctor is unavailable, with 8 locations, MedFast offers top quality care that is close by and the number is easy to remember. That is 321-MEDFAST. You just call 321-MEDFAST. No one wants to wait in an emergency room for hours and get even sicker when you get the high bill. What you want is medical care fast. That's why you call MEDFAST, where most patients are seen and treated in less than an hour. MEDFAST Urgent Care opens 7 days a week with the convenience of 8 locations serving Brevard County. So when you need medical care fast, call 321-MEDFAST. MEDFAST. Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great-tasting seafood, char-grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low-cost sandwiches and baskets to high-end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads, 321-268-5000, 321-268-5000, or visit them on the web at dixiecrossroads.com. Jotkoff Financial Group is a certified public accounting and a registered investment advisory firm with over 30 years of productive relationships with clients. Jotkoff Financial Group can assist you in meeting your accounting, tax, and business consulting and financial planning and insurance needs without expanding your internal workforce. With 3 locations here in Florida, here in Brevard County, Broward County, and Nassau County, contact Jotkoff Financial Group here in Brevard at 321-984-7345, located at 1122 South Wickham Road in Melbourne. That's Jotkoff Financial Group. On the web, you'll find them at www.jotkoff, that's JOTKOFF.com. Call the professionals at Jotkoff Financial Group today.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here in Cocoa, Florida on WWBC AM 1510, FM 94.7, FM 99.9, and FM 100.7. I find as I get older, I say my words a little bit clearer than I did when I was younger. It's part of aging.
That's right. It's also part of slowing down, and it's okay to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but don't forget, all of our website, all of our podcasts and so forth are on demand, and they're also on our website for under CETAMediaInc.com.
Yeah, and what a nice robust first half of the show we had with Lori Ross, who called in on behalf of Foster Adopt Connect. She is the CEO, and we talked to her, and she told us about fostering over 400 children from the ages of 5 to 34. I mean, I can just imagine what a great woman. I mean, we need more people like her.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like we said before. And of course, then our second segment is with our friend Matt Price. And Matt is a registered nurse. He works at Wusthof Hospital here in Rockledge, and he's a good friend. And we sometimes strike up these conversations with friends, whether it is about the environment or healthcare or gun violence in our schools or whatever it is, and I always meet such wonderful people that have the same interests like myself. And so Matt's one of those, and of course Ellen is as well. We have a lot in common. We met at the ABWA.
Right.
We talked about business.
Absolutely.
How to open business and write books.
Write books.
And we did that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Matt said he wanted to come on the show, one of the things I thought about was something that the Dalai Lama said. He says, man, when he was asked about humanity, this is what the Dalai Lama said. He said, man sacrifices his health in order to make money. Then he sacrifices money to recuperate his health. And then he's so anxious about the future that he does not enjoy the present. The result being that he does not live in the present or the future. He lives as if he's never going to die, and then he dies having never really lived. That's healthcare in a nutshell, I think.
Yeah, it's
isn't
like
it the
that.
Truth?
Yes.
My God. So we were talking
everybody
about
everybody looking for that magic pill that's going to make them all well in a moment.
Right. So as a nurse and practicing, and you've been practicing for over 20 years, Why do you think people are always looking for that magic pill?
I just think they want it quick and easy. You know, they don't want it to cost a lot, and they want it to be quick and easy to get back to a place where they were before in their life.
Right. But I mean, quick and easy is not always the answer. You know, someone said to me the other day, why is it a physician or his staff who is obese is telling someone else about exercise and eating in moderation and how to have preventative care? Shouldn't they lead by example? And sometimes I think about it when it comes to us as human beings. We want a doctor to fix us after we have smoked all our lives, after we drank alcohol all our lives. But nothing wrong with that. I like a little alcohol myself every once in a while. But we've seen patients who want to go back outside and smoke after they've had multiple inhalers and breathing treatments and prednisone and Lasix and everything else. But yet still, they want to go outside and get that smoke in and come back in and yell at the staff. And I'm sure you've seen that too.
Yeah.
You know,
and come back in short of breath.
Right. And it's like a never ending circle, right? And if you try to tell them or their families about their healthcare, they get upset. We say that education and awareness is what we should be doing. How do we educate more people to know about their body and their diagnosis?
I think just taking time with people and seeing where they're at is a lot of it. And, nurses and healthcare providers nowadays are rushed so much that they don't always get to have that time to sit and see where people are coming from in life and where we can meet them and educate them where they're at so that they can connect with that their own health and intervene in their own health and prevent things that may come in the future otherwise.
Yeah, I know Ellen and I, we've talked about this before, and we've talked to other friends about it too. Do you feel like healthcare has changed from nonprofit to profit? I mean, that's a question that either you or Ellen or myself could answer, right? But what do you think? Do you think it's changed?
Certainly. I mean, in the 23 years that I've been in healthcare, you know, most of the facilities that I started out in were all nonprofit, and they, provided a level of charity care. Most of them, you know, over 30% of the care that they gave was charity care. So it didn't matter who you were and where you were coming from, you were going to receive care. And things are very different nowadays. Doctors are being rushed and nurses are being rushed and all the providers are being rushed to take care of more people with less. And so I think the patients feel that when they come in, that you know, they're being rushed through, and they know that they're getting less for their insurance dollars or their other healthcare dollars that they're spending. And so that for-profit is certainly driving our healthcare and the way that we're being cared for by our providers.
Yeah, and even staffing. Like, you know, we all talk about staffing, but I wonder if the public understands that safe staffing equals quality care, right? And how do we get more people to go into a profession where so many are leaving? I mean, my gosh, I've been a nurse for over 28 years, and I love the profession. I enjoy taking care of people. But there's so many people that are leaving the profession. And the number one thing they say, I'm overwhelmed because we're understaffed. I have too many patients. I can't keep up. What can we do about that?
Well, I think there's a number of things that we could be doing. You know, obviously, trying to staff the facilities better would help decrease burnout. It improves the work environment and makes it more healthy for other people when you do have that time to connect with your patient, because most providers want to do that. They want to make sure that they're, at the end of the day, they can go home and say that they gave that 100% for those people that they love and care about. And so definitely staffing does that. You can do that many different ways. Salaries are very important. Benefits are important. Healthcare providers don't get free healthcare as much as people think that they do all the time. They don't. They have to pay insurance and other things as much as anybody else.
Yeah, I remember when my husband worked in the ER at Wusthof. He worked there for over 16 or 17 years in the ER. One of the doctors who was working in the hospital didn't have health insurance because his wife had a pre-existing condition and he had a pre-existing condition, and their combined health insurance costs for the month was probably, I think he had told us, about $1,600 a month. These were the days before the ACA and Obamacare, what some people call Obamacare. I call it Obamacares. But that's what it was. I mean, so many people don't have health insurance and they're in they work in healthcare. And the other thing, too, is, you know, I remember speaking to the CEO of the hospital once years ago. I don't even know who it was. It had to be about, I don't know, 20 years ago, a CEO of a hospital. And I said, why don't you just put more bodies on the floor to turn patients, reposition patients, give them water, actually feed them, help them to brush their teeth and do whatever. You know, we were taught in nursing school to give a back rub, to make sure people brush their teeth, to make sure you offer a drink.
Personal care.
And we don't have enough people, but then we see all these healthcare companies coming up with a wound vac and a specialty bed and all these things that cost the taxpayers more money when all you could have done was put more bodies on the floor.
Yeah.
You agree?
And, you know, the business model is, again, to do more with less. And so, you know, the way that hospitals and healthcare facilities are staffed now, they're staffed based on their average daily census. So they're not staffed based on the actual patient census that is going on that day. They're staffed based on a yearly average or a monthly average. And so, you know, a unit that may have 24 patients, their average may be that they have 20 patients. So they're not going to have any more nurses based on that 24 patients. They're only going to have nurses based on that average daily census. And that's the way the business model works, instead of it working on how most people think is what a normal ratio would
be. It's become more about customer service than patient care, don't you think?
Yeah. It's about
like
marketing
a business.
The care, making sure that you say certain things that when people get the quiz from the patient survey, that they will answer it the right way.
Yeah. I think Ellen had something to say.
No, I was just saying that the census, the survey at the end,
yeah,
you're hoping that people are going to answer it the right way and answer it the way that they think is going to be helpful. And a lot of times they were just so grateful for any of the care that they got that they don't see that it could have been better in some cases, right?
Right. Well, you know, and me, I've been a nurse. I still am, and I love it. And one of the things that I think we ought to be doing is empowering the families with questions they should ask and they should know ahead of time before someone is admitted, right? Because mm-hmm. some people come in and they bombard the nurses with so many questions when you are trying to deliver care. What are some of the things families should be asking themselves or the hospital administration before they admit someone?
I think there's a couple of different things that directions that you could go with that, because if you're going to be having a surgery in a hospital, you want to know what kind of safety ratings and things that they have. And those are things that you can talk to your doctor about. If your doctor goes to more than one hospital, you can ask of your insurance company which hospital has the highest ratings for that type of surgery that you're going to have. You can also go on to the Leapfrog Group's website, which is www.hospitalsafetygrade.org. You can go on Medicare's Hospital Compare website just by going medicare.gov/hospitalcompare. And those will help you see what type of ratings and rankings that the hospitals are getting in their safety ratings, and how many infections they're having within their facility, and how many falls that patients are having, and how many pressure sores and things that are going on there. And all those things are influenced by staff. We know that when we have more staff, the incidence of those types of events decrease. So I think it's important to be asking either your provider or the facility, how often are they having these types of events and what are they doing to prevent them? What are they going to do to keep you safe or your family members safe? You know, when you are admitted to a hospital, you need to know what doctors are in charge of your care. If it's not your normal primary care doctor, who's going to be leading your care? Are there specialists involved in your
care?
And
is the doctor just going to poke their head in the room and say hello and then charge you $200 for that? You know, that actually happened to a friend of mine. I was with her. I saw the physician come in. All she said was, how are you? And then my friend says she got billed $200. I'm like, seriously? I was there for that. Mm-hmm. She did not even touch the patient. Mm-hmm. Didn't even listen to her lungs or anything.
Yeah, that would not be an example of effective communication. Yeah.
Well, and I had the same instance where the doctor came in when my husband was in the hospital and came in at 5 o'clock in the morning. Nobody was there. He wasn't awake. He was barely awake. And the doctor's trying to have a conversation with him, never touched him, and then left. So I said, what time did he show up? He said 5 o'clock. So I sat there the next morning at 5 o'clock in the morning waiting patiently for him to show up. And he did. And I said, we can't have this.
Yeah.
You know, you can't show up without some kind of, not that you have to have an appointment, but give me an idea that you're going to be here at 5 o'clock in the morning so that I can at least help decipher what you're telling us.
So how do we get rid of bad nurses or bad employers for that? Because we see it's like a 30% turnover rate. How do we get rid of them?
The national average, you know, is around 16 to 17% turnover rate. But some in our county, in some places, there are actually much higher turnover rates. And, you know, when that goes on for a prolonged period of time, you have to ask, is it really bad nurses or bad healthcare or providers, or is it bad employers? Because, you know, you can say for a little while that there's bad individuals, but as it continues to go on and on and on and on, then you have to ask yourself, what are you doing that's causing this problem?
I mean, we have to care. I mean, we have to care about, you know, where our bread is buttered. And a lot of us love our jobs and we want to see quality of care, not just where we work, but elsewhere. But I've always wondered, can litigation and social justice improve healthcare?
I think that it can, and, you know, obviously our state has chosen that we have tort reform, and so it limits the number of litigation that can occur in healthcare.
No, you know, I'm married to a physician, so I kind of like the tort reform part of it.
But, you know,
everybody wants
you have
to
ask, has it gone too far, though? Because when you have loved ones that are laying in a bed in a hospital or a healthcare facility, and they have a bed sore, and you're asking how it got there. Was it because
of
a lack
turning
of
and
staffing,
repositioning,
a lack of nutrition? What was the cause of it? Maybe it's multiple things. But, you know, unless you're a dependent of that person laying in that bed, you're not going to be able to litigate. And you know, if there's no financial loss for a facility, many times they're not all that interested in changing the way they're
solving,
doing something.
And solving whatever is going to. And, you know, the other thing, too, I think, you know, when we talk to families, we have to also ask them to be patient at times. Many times a patient will put a call light on and the nurse is tied up in another room and they're busy doing something and the families get all upset. You know, it's like you cannot be two places at one time and you don't have a lot of arms and legs either. So it's almost like it's a team effort to get someone well again. I remember once a family member came to the desk and told me that her mother's nails were dirty. And the nursing assistant was so busy doing something else, and I was busy doing something else. And I wanted to say, well, she is your mom. Get busy and clean those nails up. You know, that's what would happen in Trinidad and Tobago, where I was born and raised. It's socialized medicine, but the families are so involved in the care of a loved one. And you find that people, when they have someone who loves them and care about them, they do heal faster. Do you see that when families are involved, that people, I'm not saying that the family should give them a bed bath and give them medications and put an IV, but there's something called love and compassion that you could get from your own.
Yeah, certainly just the normal activities of daily living, families can certainly participate in that. And that interaction is healthy for the person to heal, and having the family there is important. But yeah, you can ask the nurse about what things are okay to participate in the care. But many times helping with bathing or those other sorts of things you can do, you can help with.
What about the dreaded EMR? I mean, a lot of us were used to charting. We love sitting down and doing our charts. The young generation loves the computer. Ellen loves the computer.
I do love that.
But I remember the days when you just chart about a patient and you had more time. Are we so consumed with paperwork that we don't spend enough time with the patients?
I think so. You know, I like it when the manager says, I want you to care for your patient first. And if that means that you don't get your charting done until the end of the shift, then that's fine. But that's not said everywhere. Many times it's, we have to do real-time charting. We have to, you know, keep up with our charting, and because I don't want you on overtime at the end of the shift charting something. And, you know, the EMR itself is a very complex system, and many facilities, you know, change them every few years or every 2 or 3 years. So the nurses have to retrain and learn that new system. And then as with any system...
And that's about money, too.
Yeah.
The hospitals switch the systems based on how much money they can save. They're not even thinking the poor nurse has to bathe the patient, feed the patient, put in an IV, get staff in there to help. I mean, it's a lot.
Yeah. And the transition to those systems is just more stress on the healthcare providers, because their goal is to take care of the patient, not be taking care of a computer system and trying to work out all of its glitches and things that that all new systems have. So
yeah,
it can be very frustrating on top of just trying to provide care in a short-staffed environment.
True. And so now in the state of Florida, we have to be compliant with the renewal license. We have to pay a fee. We have to make sure we get all the AIDS and HIV classes done. We have to do, there's one now for about bullying and domestic violence, medication errors, the laws for the state, all these things. And the state is making a little change of these nurses and their fees as well. But is the state of Florida the only state that's taking action against nurses?
Right now, the state of Florida is actually one of 22 states that have laws in place that if healthcare providers and some other professionals are behind on their student loans or have defaulted on them, they can actually take action against them. And the state of Florida is the only one doing that at this time. I know a nurse at our facility that was unable to work for a while because her license was suspended until she could come up with a better plan with the loan provider, you know, that she had defaulted on the loan. And so for her to, you know, practice again with her license, she had to become current with those payments. And, you know, so depending on how many thousands of dollars you have in student loans, you can... That payment can be $400, $500, $600 a month.
It's like loan sharking.
That's a lot of money, you know.
Come on, state of Florida. Be nice to your nurses.
No.
Do you understand what it is to have to get your CEUs in and get all these little tests done?
It's like debtor's prison.
It is. Yeah, totally. You know, I use Western Schools. I've been using them for the last 28 years of my life. And they're wonderful because I get a book. I get it done. Then I get all my tests done and I mail it in, and a CE broker sends me a little something, and I'm happy because you could make your little change again. But it is a lot to keep up with just being a nurse, the stress, the lack of teamwork sometimes. I mean, it is. So I think the state need to come and talk to people like you and I and other nurses in the profession and see how difficult it is before they decide to go after a nurse for something like that.
We'll certainly have a town hall and start coming up with some solutions.
Well,
right?
And we already know there are loan forgiveness programs in this country, but through the federal system right now, they're not being exercised. You can talk to people that will tell you that they were told that if they went into a nonprofit healthcare profession that they would have loan forgiveness, and now they're finding out that's not true, and they're being responsible for these huge student loans. I mean, many nurses come out of school with $40,000, $50,000, $60,000
in
debt. Student loan debt, and doctors over $100,000,
$200,000 some of them. You know, sometimes a lot of facilities have like these monthly mandatory meetings, and I had a friend, a physician, who once spoke up at a facility, at a hospital. You know, I've lived in several states, but I'm not going to say the state. But I'll say he was a physician. And he spoke up about the short staffing in the emergency room and that he felt it was putting the patients' lives at risk because the hospitals were cutting so much many services. And he literally, in 2 weeks, he was gone. People are afraid to speak up, I think. And why do you think they are?
Yeah, well, I think they are because there's no laws to protect the healthcare provider. There are no anti-retaliation laws for a healthcare provider that is a whistleblower. And until we have whistleblower protection laws...
Not in this state.
No, not in this state.
No, unfortunately, if you're going after nurses... with their license for things that you can, they can sit down, the managers can sit down and talk with a nurse, but we're finding out that that's not happening. I mean, I don't think they will do that for them. And if they say something that they think is detrimental to the hospital, it's all about, sometimes I think it's all about the bottom line, and which is happens to be money.
Yeah, it does seem that way, more so. And not even just in the for-profit systems, even in the nonprofit systems, we need to be asking those questions about how much charity care are they actually providing to the community? What foundation do they have? If you're being admitted to a hospital and you don't have insurance and you need assistance, that's the kind of question you need to ask. How do I apply for charitable care in this facility?
Right.
Yeah, I think people should not shy away from asking questions. You know, we all wake up every day and we want to be the best we can be and appreciate ourselves and those around us. But, you know, things like preventative care, which diagnostic tests that someone is performing on you, don't be afraid to ask the questions. And I find that a lot of patients are. Why are they afraid to ask questions?
Well, in the past, it was you went to your local provider and you had that care done. Nowadays, you need to compare. You need to see... maybe that test is done less expensive down the street,
yep,
somewhere else or in the county over. If it's a non-emergent test, we need to shop around. We need to hold people accountable for their tests. I mean, the amount of costs that we bill for and actually what's paid by the insurance are two very different things.
Right.
But if you're going in as a private pay patient, that total bill is what you're going to get, not what the insurance gets.
When did it change with the remaining minute where healthcare became a business, that they started to put profits before people? I mean, how can we figure out when this went from the Florence Nightingale type of nursing to just money? Do you have a quick answer for that?
Well, we know that technology certainly increased healthcare costs. It's things that we do need, but it does increase costs. So we do have need for more money in healthcare. But at the same time, where is the other dollars going that increases that cost? And so we need to look at those administrative costs and things that we see CEOs and upper management making huge sums.
Yeah, a CEO with a four-year degree from a college can make over $200,000, whereas the nurses are making $18 to $20 an hour and they're sweating like on the floor,
and
you know?
And the for-profit stock options and everything else.
Yeah, well, I think we ought to look at that.
Again, a great discussion.
We'll have another show on this.
We're going to have another show on this,
because I am
for
concerned
sure
about this. I want to know why they're making so much money when the nurses on the floor and the nursing assistants and the support staff is not. I'm coming with a clipboard.
Matt Price, thank you so much. Lori
thank
Ross, thank
me.
You so much for having us on being on the show today. And we'll be right back next week with another Viewpoint with CNN Friends.
This is the Christian Voice of Brevard on WWBC 1510 AM.